Welcome to today's City Club of Boise Forum with Dr. David Adler talking about this post-presidential period and what's ahead for our country. My name is Bill Manny, and I'm a past president of City Club, and I'll be the moderator for today's conversation. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I'd like to take a few minutes to thank those organizations that help us achieve our mission of ensuring compelling conversations, engaged citizens, and a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. We also receive support from our Forum Series sponsors, AARP of Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mine Development. City Club of Boise also receives support through a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thanks also to our media partners, Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, University of Idaho, BSU, and NNU. Today's program is also co-sponsored by both the Republican and Democratic parties of the state of Idaho. So we want to thank both those organizations for sponsoring this conversation. So let's get to our program. Dr. David Adler is with us today. He is president of the Altura Institute. He's lectured nationally and internationally on the Constitution and presidential power. His scholarly writings have been invoked by the U.S. Supreme Court, the Justice Department, the White House, and by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. He's taught courses on the Constitution at all three Idaho universities. At Idaho State University, he served as director of the Center for the Study of the Constitution. At the University of Idaho, the James and Louise McClure Professor of Public Policy, served as director of the McClure Center, and was a member of the faculty of the College of Law. At Boise State University, he was the Cecil D. Andrus Professor of Public Policy and served as director of the Andrus Institute. So, given these unprecedented times, I could spend a long disquisition here setting us up, but let's just go straight to Dr. Adler to talk about kind of where we are and what he sees ahead. So go ahead, Dr. Adler.
Thank you very much, Bill, for that kind introduction. It's good to be with you and all members of the City Club of Boise. We meet on a very important occasion. If we were to set the stage and to identify where America stands on this hour on December 3rd, 2020, we note that this is a very grim time in American history. We're in the midst of a horrific pandemic that has taken more than 275,000 American lives. Just yesterday, as you know, some 2,800 Americans died, essentially the same number of people that were killed on 9/11. And projections are this is sadly going to be a daily occurrence. Indeed, models indicate that by February 1, tragically, we may lose some 500,000 Americans. All of this, of course, is the background against which we talk and discuss this recent election, this ongoing election. Here we are, 30 days after the election. The sitting president of the United States, Donald Trump, still refuses to accept the results of the election. It certainly is well within his right, or any presidential candidate who has lost in the general election, to take action in the courts, both federal and state. And that's certainly what President Trump has done, but he has lost time and again in state after state, in both state and federal courts. That part of his contestation of the electoral results is not particularly bothersome. What is of deep concern, I think, to most Americans is his effort to bring down the sideboards of democracy and to undercut the structure of our constitutional system, to tear away at the pillars and posts of our constitutional platform by, among other things, baselessly asserting that the election was rigged, that it was the result of fraud. Most recently, in a 46-minute rant on Facebook yesterday, not covered by any networks, by the way, he indicated that the fraud was the result of a carefully coordinated plot to bring him down. And so we not only gather today in the midst of this horrific pandemic, but also in the context of a president who has refused to accept the elections. Now, that needn't deter us, particularly from going forward with President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, but it has slowed the process, and this is critical, and this is very, very troublesome, because by waiting so long after the election to authenticate the results of the election, the General Services Administrator refused to release critical funds so that the Biden team could move forward with its plans in the transition. And more than that, of course, there are many who suspect that President Trump may in fact be engaged in this delay effort intentionally, perhaps to undercut the potential progress of the Biden administration, to slow it down on day one on January 20. Who knows what his particular motives are at this point in time? But it's troubling that we have not yet seen the president behave in the way that all of his predecessors have, going back to the very first presidential election, or at least the second one after John Adams was defeated by Thomas Jefferson in the election of 1800. And though that election was very bitter, John Adams had very many kind and gracious things to say about his opponent. And that set the tone for the behavior of subsequent presidents, even presidents who felt bitterly disappointed about the outcome of the election. Consider Richard Nixon in 1960, narrowly eclipsed by John Kennedy. He and his camp thought dead persons had voted, and that's how Kennedy won the election. But despite that speculation, Richard Nixon never considered the idea of refusing to accept the election results. Or if you want a high note of graciousness, let's cite Al Gore in the 2000 presidential election. We're all familiar with that, as bitter a contest as we've seen in American history, at least since 1800. But Al Gore didn't want to delay after the Supreme Court ruling and fight on. He thought that it would be better for America, a reflection of the rule of law, if in fact he did concede and offer his support to George W. Bush. What President Trump's delaying efforts tell us, of course, is that there's an opportunity to put substance over form. The form at this point would call for the incumbent president, defeated on Election Day, to concede, to open up the White House, to open up federal agencies, to open up all the relevant checking accounts, to aid and assist the Biden administration as it goes forward in the name of trying to get a running start to address the pandemic. But that would be the form. The substance, of course, is foot dragging, a refusal to participate. We won't see, I'm pretty certain at this point, President Trump inviting Joe Biden and Jill Biden to the White House, as past presidents have, to have an hour of tea and talk a little bit to show the American people that here in the United States, we emphasize continuity, that we hand off the baton in a peaceful, gracious way, and we go about our business. That substance, that symbolism is very, very important. We're not going to see that. What we hear now is that it's very unlikely that President Trump will attend the inaugural speech. That seems highly unlikely, and as reports indicated, it seems more likely that President Trump on Inauguration Day, January 20, is going to make his own announcement that he's going to seek the presidency in 2024, thus attempting to overshadow or undercut, choose your metaphor, President Biden's inaugural address. We'll see. So we're concerned at this point, not only about the pandemic, which hovers above our every move, and we worry about how dreadful this is going to be over the next weeks and months, but we worry about the efforts by the sitting president to undercut our constitutional democracy. And to add fuel to the fire, we just learned, unfortunately, that General Mike Flynn, has called for President Trump to suspend the Constitution, to impose limited martial law, to silence the media, and to call for a new election, a new presidential election, which the military would supervise. Folks, this is really the essence of a coup against American democracy. And so that is deeply troubling. Of course, perhaps some people will read into the recent pardon of General Flynn the motives of Donald Trump. Why would Mike Flynn come forward at this very point, retweet call for the suspension of the Constitution? What does this portend for American democracy? On the very bright side, of course, we find that 80 million Americans spoke loudly in favor of the Biden-Harris ticket, a record number of votes cast for any presidential ticket in the history of the United States. That would constitute roughly a 6 or 7 million margin of victory over Donald Trump in terms of the popular vote. President-elect Biden has won a decisive electoral college vote. We will see the final results on December 14, just around the corner. But each state now has certified the results. But of course, that bright note for many Americans reflected in President-elect Biden's statement to America, help is on the way, which means he intends to aggressively address the pandemic, which would represent a sharp turn of presidential behavior compared to that of the sitting president, and that he intends to work with Congress to move forward on an all-important infrastructure bill, to move the economy along by providing critical aid relief, perhaps along the lines of the bill that the House of Representatives passed last May, but has been ignored by the Senate under the control of Mitch McConnell. There are other measures in play, legislation that President-elect Biden would very much hope to push forward very quickly and perhaps provide a semblance of the rapidity of FDR's first 100 days. Lord knows our economy needs help. The relief is not only going to attempt to put food on the table of millions of Americans who struggle to feed their families every day, but allow those same people to pay the mortgage, to pay rent. Those people have lost their health care. America finds itself in dire straits. And so the opportunity to invite a new presidential team into the White House is a welcome note of relief for many Americans, but not all, obviously, because as you well know, 70 million Americans voted for President Trump. They wanted him to stay there. They very much wanted another 4 years. And so that raises the question about the capacity of the American government to function in the days ahead as we witness, very likely witness, divided government. I add a caveat here because, as the world knows, the eyes of America are on the state of Georgia for that January 5 runoff, when both U.S. Senate seats are subjected to the will and temperament of Georgian voters, and that's critical. If the Republicans succeed in winning those seats, then Mitch McConnell retains the title of Senate Majority Leader. If, however, the Democrats win those seats, then the Democrats will control the Senate. Chuck Schumer will be the leader, and there will be an opportunity for the Biden team to get more accomplished. So much hinges on the outcome of that election. But suppose for a moment that the Republicans win those seats. Then the future of America in the next months and next couple of years very much hinge on the ability of President-elect Biden and Mitch McConnell to work together. And so great questions loom large. Are we likely to see bipartisanship? Or will we see, for example, a determination by the putative Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a replay of what he did in 2008, when he made it clear to everybody that he intended to block the efforts of President Obama to thwart his efforts in order to ensure that President Obama would be a one-term president. This is public record. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not speculating. The world knows this. So at this pivotal moment, we would ask, is it possible for Biden and McConnell to work together to find some common ground, or will there simply be a concerted effort to advance one's political interest? And in McConnell's view, that would mean to ensure that Republicans could retake control of the White House in 2024. So you see why so much depends on this election in Georgia. And when all is said and done, I'm pretty certain we're going to see incredible amounts of money spent on that election by both sides. But when I say both sides, we have another wrench thrown into the efforts by the Republicans, because we have seen exposed by President Trump and his followers an effort to undermine that very election. Consider this spectacle, and it is a spectacle. Mitch McConnell and the GOP very badly want to win those elections to maintain control of the Senate. But what have we heard in the last 48 hours? Leaders of President Trump's campaign, don't let them steal the election, or that's how it's roughly named, have now proceeded to say to Georgia voters, don't vote. Sit this out. The election is rigged. Why in the world would President Trump and his supporters be leading such a cause, which could only help Democrats at the polls? I think the obvious answer is President Trump is looking at his own status, his own future, because the more people join him in alleging that the election was rigged, that it was a result of fraud, the better able he is to maintain his grasp on the Republican Party and perhaps to, in fact, pursue the presidential nomination in 2024. But this cannot, this muttering cannot serve the broader interests of the GOP in any way, shape, or form, because they very much want to win control of the Senate. So here we have some infighting in the state of Georgia, and it's become very, very ugly, as you know, because supporters of Trump have said, let's lock up the Georgia governor, who is a Republican. They've called on the Georgia governor and the Secretary of State in Georgia to resign. So there is a fight for purity, in a sense, within the Republican Party, and in some ways a Stalinesque effort to purge the party of Republicans who are not sufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. None of this can serve the long-term interests of the GOP. So when we look at that Georgia election on January 5, we recognize how much the outcome of that election will affect the future of America. Let us suppose further that, in fact, McConnell retains his position as Senate Majority Leader. Would it not be in his interest to try to satisfy the needs of Americans by moving forward with the kind of massive economic relief legislation that people need all over this country, in Idaho and elsewhere, as millions of people have lost their jobs, people facing increased food insecurity? Would it not be in his interest to support a huge infrastructure bill to put America back to work, to forward the economic efforts to regain our traction and improve our economic standing, and of course to rebuild the bridges and the roads that badly need our attention? Would it not be in his interest then to work with Joe Biden? That's why I say so much depends on the outcome of that election as we look at the weeks and days ahead. At this point, I have to say that I'm, in addition to those concerns, I'm very, very focused on the health or the fragility of American democracy. As many Americans are aware, the founding fathers were overwhelmingly concerned about the fragility of the republic. They understood from their own reading of history that republics simply didn't last very long. One thing or another would bring down the republic. And so the letters, the literature of the time, the speeches given by America's leaders reflect many lamentations, mournful thoughts about the future of the republic. We have to say that as we see what I regard as a concerted effort by President Trump to undermine the strength of our democracy, that our forefathers' concerns were certainly well placed. And so the concern, so the question arises, what can we Americans do at this point to fortify our constitutional democracy? I think it begins by agreeing that we, the people, have a terrific responsibility to hold government accountable. Many of you are familiar with James Madison's writing in Federalist Number 51, my favorite, I think it's a work of genius, in which he said, by the way, that the great obstacle confronting our system in 1787 was finding a way to persuade the government to obey the law. I submit that was not only the great challenge in 1787, it remains the great challenge in our time. And so Madison said, we look beyond the doctrine of separation of powers and checks and balances, and we look to the responsibility of Americans themselves to assume the many roles that we can as citizens, or what I like to call Madisonian monitors, to carefully monitor and examine what government is doing in this specific case, to make sure that our governmental officials are, in fact, adhering to the principles and the tenets of American constitutional democracy. We can remember, of course, as we all learned in elementary and junior high, that when the framers left their work behind on September 17, 1787, Ben Franklin walked out onto the streets, and he was met by a woman who said, tell us, Dr. Franklin, what kind of system of government have you given us? And he replied, madam, a republic if you can keep it. Well, we are the you. It's our responsibility, particularly in these difficult times when we see at least one half of Congress sitting on its hands, unwilling to try to advance legislation when Americans so desperately need relief in order to buy food, pay rent, pay the mortgage, pay their health care premiums, that Americans need to assume the responsibility. We need to place that on our own shoulders in order to hold government accountable. And that means that we in Idaho have that responsibility. It's not partisan at all, I think, to say that at this point in time, the silence of Idaho's congressional delegation is not only not serving the interest of Idahoans, but it's disserving the interests of Americans everywhere. And when I say the silence of Idaho's congressional delegations, I mean the silence in their failure to say to President Trump, stop tearing down the sideboards of our American democracy. It's okay if you want to challenge the electoral results in the court system. That's part of the system. But to go beyond and to try to hurt American democracy by essentially practicing a scorched field approach or throwing salt into the field so nothing can grow, that seems to me a real failure on the part of our congressional representatives. Ironically, our senator to the South, Mitt Romney of Utah, has been at the forefront of leadership efforts by calling on Trump to cease and desist those attacks on our democracy, just as he has exhibited in the last week his participation in a bipartisan effort to promote a $900 billion legislative relief package. We'll see where that goes. I fervently wish that our legislative representatives from the state of Idaho would say to the president, enough is enough. We are disappointed that you lost the election, but stop tearing away at the structure of our constitutional system. Here is an area where silence is complicity. And the day will come when we tally the score and we ask, who stood by America's constitutional democracy in these darkest hours? And ladies and gentlemen, I'm not certain that the skies are bright over the next 45 days or so before the Trump administration comes to an end. Who knows if there is mischief being cooked up by people who are loyal, passionate Trump supporters, perhaps without the knowledge of Donald Trump. We return to this crazy call to suspend the Constitution and to impose martial law. Let us assume for a moment that has nothing to do with Donald Trump. Let's assume that Donald Trump had no knowledge of it. Is it not a scary moment in American history when loyal, passionate supporters are essentially calling for extra legal measures, actions beyond the confines of our Constitution to subvert the election results? I remember very well then the writings of James Madison in the Federalist Papers, that we the people have a principal obligation to safeguard our constitutional system. And wherever we see violations of the Constitution, whether committed by liberals or conservatives, Republicans or Democrats, it is incumbent upon us to cry foul, to shout down those constitutional violations, because if we don't, then we have only ourselves to blame if the Constitution unravels and we see an unholy replacement. On that high note, let me stop here. I hope there are a lot of good questions, and the more troublesome, the better. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Dr. Adler. We do have a number of questions. Let me pause here and remind our listeners that this is also being broadcast on Boise State Public Radio. And for those radio listeners, this is a forum with Dr. David Adler of the Boise City Club, looking at kind of analyzing the politics after the presidential election. Dr. Adler, maybe this is a half full, half empty question. Let's talk about democracy itself. You know, what have we learned about our democracy? And maybe here's the question. Michael Flynn's call for suspending the Constitution has been condemned by a number of people, including the military itself. The courts seem to be working. The elections officials in all of the states seem to be doing their jobs. Isn't this, couldn't one argue that this is maybe evidence that democracy's institutions are vibrant and robust and can withstand these tensions?
Yes, I like that question very much, Bill. Thank you. And so I think it is, as you characterize it, a glass half full, half empty. On the one hand, yes, we have seen a rousing turnout by the American people, record numbers to essentially say, we no longer want this president in office, we want an alternative. And so we would say that the will of the people strongly endorses a Biden-Harris ticket. And we also can say, as you've pointed out, that the courts have turned back these baseless charges, these baseless efforts brought by the Trump team to subvert the election results. And it is also very good news to hear that the military would have nothing to do with General Flynn's call for what is, in no uncertain terms, a coup. All of that is very good news. What still troubles me, of course, is the strength of the fiber of our democracy, because we have 70 million people that seem not to have been bothered by 4 years of President Trump's assertions of unprecedented powers. As a constitutional scholar, for example, it keeps me up at night to hear the president assert such things as, under Article 2, I have absolute power. I have unlimited power. That goes beyond anything that any president has ever asserted in our country's history. That is a direct assault on American constitutionalism. And of course, the framers created a presidency of sharply limited power. So that's troubling to me. It's also troubling that Americans, some 70 million strong, would not have seemed so bothered by the president's characterization of the media as, quote, enemies of the people, a dark, horrific phrase drawn from the depths of the 20th century, utilized by the terrible totalitarians that rose to power, but found in the origins of the French Revolution, a bloody phrase that took the lives of many Frenchmen, and that more Americans would not be concerned. I say this again as a constitutional scholar, that more Americans would not be concerned about the way in which the administration was able to subvert the constitutional role of Congress in carrying out its checks and balances the past 4 years. We have seen Congress lying in a prone position, unwilling, for example, to assert its authority to conduct oversight responsibilities, so critical that it has essentially turned away from its responsibilities, not only in foreign affairs, but in domestic affairs. And while we could talk forever about the failed effort to impeach President Trump, the very fact that the Senate would not even hear evidence will forever bother me. So the story of Congress lying down in the face of presidential aggrandizement of power is not a new story, let's be fair, because constitutional scholars and critics of Congress over the years have pointed fingers at Congress. But we've never experienced something quite like these past 4 years. So that's just a few concerns I have to say that I'm still mightily concerned about the fragility of our republic.
Since we're dealing with this notion of martial law and the constitutional limits on the president, what for our viewers and listeners, what are the opportunities for a president to declare martial law? What is the constitutional role there? How and when would it be appropriate?
Yeah, great question. I think that's really important to address. So there are a couple of comments here. The first to note is there's been a public misperception about the ability of the President of the United States to deploy troops into states to quell some minor disturbances. President Trump wanted to do that, for example, when fighting or some riots broke out in various cities across the country. Here's what the law says. A 1792 statute, revised a bit in 1807, provides that the president may deploy troops, but only after the governor of a state has requested the president to send in the troops. And the rationale for that gubernatorial request would be that the ordinary law enforcement forces have been overwhelmed by the rioters or the troublemakers. So note that the founders of our country, the very men who wrote the Constitution and sharply limited executive powers, were not willing to write statutes essentially conveying to the president broad authority to send in troops whenever he wanted to. And that's because the framers of the Constitution rightfully feared the creation of an embryonic monarchy. They had feared King George III, whom they regarded as a tyrant. And they were keen students of history, and history told them that executives of many stripes and colors are prone to practice oppression. So they withheld that power from the president. The first statute, by the way, not only required a gubernatorial certification, but certification by a federal judge. Think about those incredible checks before a president could have access to the troops and deploy them. On the broader question of martial law, it still is the case that before there could be any kind of basis for a president to declare martial law, we would have to face a widespread insurrection or rebellion, which again would overwhelm the capacity of ordinary law enforcement to handle the situation. Of course, we've seen nothing like that here in America in the last year or so. Not likely to see it. The only way it would occur, frankly, is if somebody schemed in a very cynical, manipulative way to unleash violence in various places, to gin up the very kind of violence which would then provide a basis for the president, in theory, to deploy troops. But that also would have to require compliance by people in the military or the National Guard. I'm not sure that General Milley, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is at all willing to participate in this. And let me share a story with you. Many of members of the audience may remember in those last days of Watergate, the crushing pressure of Watergate bringing Richard Nixon to his knees. The Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, a well-known Republican, a lifelong friend and supporter of Richard Nixon, took the extraordinary precaution of phoning the Joint Chiefs of Staff to say, if you receive a call from the White House asking you to deploy troops, do not do it unless that call comes from me. that was an extraordinary moment, a chilling moment, because there was a rock-ribbed conservative friend of Richard Nixon, no liberal opponent or enemy of Nixon, making that call because he feared what pressure might induce Richard Nixon to do. I wonder if we have a similar person in place now. And I wonder that because, as you all know, it was just 10 days ago that the President of the United States fired the Secretary of Defense and the number two person and the number three person and replaced them with Trump loyalists. I'm not suggesting that we're back in those last days of 1974, but history has a rhyme to it. So I like that precaution taken by Schlesinger. My own sense is that General Mark Milley is of the same fiber. And one more note, we could talk about this issue for weeks on end. But some of those calling for President Trump to declare martial law are looking to Abraham Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus in 1862. And while we could go on to talk about this, the key point of difference here is that Washington was being infiltrated by Southern soldiers, espionage agents, traitors. It was hard to know if Washington would stand yet another night or two. That was Lincoln's great challenge. The important thing to note is that President Lincoln, who engaged in a very thorough constitutional explanation of his authority to do so, noted that this constituted the very kinds of conditions that the framers had in mind, insurrection and rebellion. And without delving into the details, it's important to note that Congress later passed retroactive legislation affirming and authorizing President Lincoln's suspension of habeas corpus so as to provide full constitutional authorization for his action.
So while we're talking about presidential power, let's several questions about pardon powers. Can a president pardon himself? And maybe a corollary, can a president or has a president ever pardon members of his own family?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's certainly the burning question of the moment, isn't it? Dominating headlines. Let me say, first of all, that just recently, I delivered a YouTube talk on this question, and the response has been great. It's now over 21,000 views and climbing. So I'll ask someone to send a link to the City Club, and maybe your members would be interested. But I've written on this, written scholarly work, so I was simply drawing on those works over the years. The pardon power is a sweeping power granted to the president, but not terribly unchecked. That is, the framers held their breath when they granted the president the pardon power because they wrote against a backdrop of English legal history, which indicated that English kings were notorious for abusing that power, sometimes to add to their own checking account, sometimes to build up an army for many reasons, to serve their own pecuniary, political, and personal reasons. The framers then approached this question with trepidation. What finally provided them with the relief that they needed to grant this pardon power to the president was the availability of the impeachment power. Alexander Hamilton said in the convention, if in fact the president were to abuse the pardon power, he could be impeached for it. And in those days, people took the impeachment power seriously, and they thought that was a sufficient check. Times have changed. At any rate, there was never any contemplation that a president could pardon himself. The reality is, if a president could pardon himself, then it would be placing him above the law. He could engage in any conduct and essentially avoid any kind of criminal inquiry or prosecution. That would violate what the framers considered the very concept of the rule of law. The rule of law at the time of our founding had a very specific meaning, and that was that the president is subordinate to the law. And as James Wilson said in the Constitutional Convention, the president would not enjoy any other privilege, not enjoyed by American citizens. So nobody in the convention ever discussed the concept of a self-pardon. But in addition, it would violate a self-pardon, would also violate a historical maxim as old as Anglo-American legal history itself, going all the way back to the year 1610, when the famous Sir Edward Coke said that no man could be judge, jury, and executioner in his own cause. That has never been disturbed. And so there's no support in our system. There are many reasons. Your viewers could look at my talk called Four Reasons Why Donald Trump May Not Pardon Himself. There are many reasons, but let's get clear on this to answer your question. No president has ever asserted the authority to pardon himself. Richard Nixon contemplated it for a short time. He turned to his attorney, Leonard Garment, and asked, what if I pardon everybody around me and I pardon myself? Now, that would be a way to avoid all troubles. Leonard Garment, even though he was in the loyal service to his president, his client said, that would be grotesque. That was his word. It would be grotesque. It would be, quote, to say hell with our system of justice. So Nixon, as badly as he sought protection, never seriously contemplated it and dropped the notion after hearing that. While there's no basis for a president to pardon himself, yes, the answer to whether a president can pardon family members is very definitely yes. And we need to look no further than Bill Clinton's action in the last hours of his presidency when he pardoned his brother, Roger. And I think Bill Clinton was pardoning a lot of people in the last 16 or 20 hours. I think he pulled an all-nighter, drank lots of coffee, pardoned a slew of people who didn't deserve it. But pardoning one's family members is different than pardoning himself. Much could be said about this. I'll give a public talk later on this.
Or we can watch your YouTube video as well, right?
Thank you.
The power of impeachment to limit a president's abuse of the pardon doesn't really work if it's in the last days or hours of a presidency, does it? That's really not a very effective leash on that power.
That's right. Yes, it would be ineffectual at this point, exactly as you say, and thus not a deterrent. And how would Donald Trump be deterred or stopped from doing that? One wonders about the kind of case that could be brought before a court, perhaps all the way to the Supreme Court. And it may be a case that's already essentially underway in investigation, going back to the president's alleged payment to a call girl and then violating campaign finance laws. And Michael Cohen, of course, was arrested, convicted for his role in that. That's the kind of case. Let's imagine hypothetically that the federal prosecutor moves forward to charge President Trump for his role in violating federal campaign finance laws and other statutes in that episode. And then President Trump pleads a self-pardon. For all we know, in fact, President Trump has already pardoned himself for any offense that he has committed or may have committed against the United States from the day he took office to January 20 of 2021. And it's locked away in a vault somewhere. And he pulls out the pardon and says, I can't be prosecuted. I pardon myself. That's the kind of case that could come before the courts. And then the courts would have to determine if there's any basis for a self-pardon. And as I mentioned, there were already a couple of strong reasons why he could not. But if you wanted to delve into this just a little bit more, in the Constitutional Convention itself, when some framers expressed alarm that a president might utilize, that is, abuse the pardon power to protect himself by pardoning all of his aides and cronies involved in a treasonous act, then how would you deter that? That was the framers' nightmare, that the president might pardon aides and cronies to protect himself. If the framers were absolutely opposed to that and thus offered impeachment as the response, surely they could not have entertained the idea that a president could pardon himself. So the reason why I offer this is not only because it's compelling to explain the framers' mindset in writing the pardon clause, but if you think about the current Supreme Court, we have three, maybe four members of the court who style themselves originalists. That is to say, they preach the doctrine of interpreting the Constitution in light of the framers' intentions. If they truly are consistent and they go back to the convention debates, they would have no choice but to rule against President Trump. How's that for a prediction?
All right. We'll revisit that at some future date. Let's talk a little bit about the incoming Biden administration and several questions kind of asking Idaho-related questions. Is there any sense for what his administration or his appointments might mean for Idaho? And I guess I would tack onto that both Anthony Blinken and Bruce Reed, who are close Biden allies, have at least tangential connections to Idaho. Do you have any thoughts on kind of the Biden administration and what we can expect in Idaho?
You know, I like this very much. The fact is, I'm very, very happy that we have such stalwart thinkers and leaders with an Idaho connection who provide a key, who are key components of the Biden administration. Blinken's experience in diplomacy and foreign affairs, of course, is well known, and he's worked with Biden for years. That's a real plus. And of course, Reid has been an exemplary worker on behalf of Biden and Democratic causes for years, has fine parentage up in North Idaho, by the way. Good friends. Mary Lou is a good friend. The reality is that what the Biden administration can do for Idaho is very strong and very positive. So, for example, if the Biden administration does move quickly to address the pandemic as it wants to, that will have a direct effect on the health and welfare of Idahoans who are suffering from the pandemic. We all know how it's raging through our state. That's a direct plus. If the Biden administration is able to move forward very quickly with a massive infrastructure bill, that can help put Idahoans back to work and repair the bridges and roads in Idaho. All you have to do is to drive from Boise north, and you'll realize how badly we need those repairs. I think on a larger scale, Joe Biden's commitment to gender equality is flourishing. It's great evidence of the fact that he intends to live up to his word to make his cabinet 50% women. And you look at the fact that his communications team, so vital to the success of any administration, is comprised entirely of women, or that he has already nominated at least women to vital cabinet posts. Those are a plus. When women get closer to enjoying gender equality, that benefits everybody, including Idahoans, obviously. I think back to the wonderful remark by Warren Buffett of a few years ago when he said, America's done pretty well over 200 years just using half our population. Just think of what we could achieve if we use the other half. Well, here's Joe Biden moving forward to help women at every turn. I like that very much. And then there's no doubt that President Biden is going to move forward with an enhancement of the Affordable Health Care Act. He wants, for example, to lower the Medicare age from 65 to 60, which will be very beneficial to Idahoans. Making health care more accessible and affordable to Idahoans is important. Putting Idahoans back to work is critical. When we live in a state at this point where 20% of the workforce in Idaho is currently working two jobs and still requiring some state assistance, that's repugnant to the concept of human dignity. Nobody should have to work more than a job in order to put food on the table and pay rent and pay for health care. That's obscene. So I think Biden's administration is going to have a direct impact on the quality of life for average, ordinary Idahoans up and down the state.
I should note that Alan Blinken, who was the 2002 candidate for the Senate against Larry Craig, is Anthony Blinken's uncle and resides, or part of the time at least, in Sun Valley. So that was I didn't provide that context.
Oh, but and thank you. And I regard Alan as a friend, and he's been a wonderful actor in the world of diplomacy. And it's nice to have that connection. Let's hope that we see his nephew in Idaho more often now.
That's right. So one of our viewers did ask about legal action against the Trump administration. What should the Biden administration approach be? And what is your view of the potential healing after this very, very, tense and bitter process we went through? And before you answer that question, I just want to remind our viewers that this is a City Club of Boise program with Dr. David Adler, and we're looking at the post-election politics after the presidential election, and we are broadcasting this at a future date on Boise State Public Radio. So, kind of, Dr. Adler, healing, and what is your sense for what is needed now?
You know, Bill, I think that's the right question at this time, because America does need to find ways to heal and to unite and to overcome the deep fractures that separate Americans. The election demonstrates that more than ever. And so how to do that? First, I think that Joe Biden has the capacity to help heal these deep wounds that afflict the nation, primarily because his history as a U.S. senator and then his record as a vice president reflect the fact that he is able to work both sides of the aisle. And I think that is a real strength. And though he was criticized by some of his opponents in the Democratic primary, I regard that as a real strength. Let's hope, as he suggests, that he can work with Senate Leader Mitch McConnell if necessary. So I think there is that prospect that can be very real. That would be a wonderful thing to do to set a tone for the country. It's one thing to listen to the words, the tone of the President of the United States. As we've said, we've been reminded of this every day, that the president's words matter. President-elect Biden has already delivered a number of speeches which have set the right tone. And he has indicated he wants to be president for all Americans, not just Democrats. I think that's the right tone. The temperament is good. And if he can demonstrate an ability to work across the aisle and we can achieve genuine bipartisan leadership in the area of relief, legislation, infrastructure, working on health care, that can encourage American citizens to lower the temperature from a fever pitch where it is boiling to a point where we can speak to each other again. I think that's critically important. So let's not underestimate the temperament and the words of the person in the Oval Office and just the influential nature of that behavior across the country. And then I hope American citizens will recognize that, in fact, politics should not be warfare, that words should not be bullets, that we can, in fact, work together to find compromise, and that we would not only lower the temperature, but pull back our ideological instincts for a time and recognize that the way forward is to seek compromise, which, after all, is the engine of American democracy. So in our own communities, in states across the countries, I think that Americans can be encouraged to do that, because in the end, we all have the same interest, particularly in this very difficult time of a pandemic and the economic difficulties. And the other part of your question, which I think is a very important one, should there be any legal action against the Trump administration? This is always an issue that many successive administrations face as they come into power. President Obama was urged by many supporters to push forward with investigations into the Bush administration's violation of the Constitution and international law. And there was a strong case to be made for doing that. President Obama thought, if we do that, we won't be able to move forward, because if you're looking over your shoulder, it's hard to move forward, obviously. And so he deigned not to do that. Now there's great pressure to thoroughly investigate President Donald Trump, his administration, and other actions. While it is possible that the Justice Department in the coming months may continue to pursue some federal avenues of investigation against Trump, the administration, his businesses, I think it's more likely that we're going to see real action at the state level, particularly in the state of New York, in the Manhattan district, or the state attorney general. So I don't think this is going to put pressure on President Biden to say yes or no to the question of whether Donald Trump should be investigated. I think, in fact, my own view is, yes, the New York law enforcement authorities should act very diligently and energetically. The difference here between President Obama's decision not to authorize investigations and our time is the fact that the Trump administration and the Trump business world have so clearly violated important statutes, particularly those that the New York authorities are investigating. If the rule of law is to mean anything at this juncture, New York state authorities must push forward. And if there are obvious violations of federal law, then in fact, we should pursue them. If we don't support the rule of law at this critical juncture, after a president has survived an impeachment hearing, which was half-baked, then I don't know how we say in the future that America is governed under the rule of law. As I've said in many other circumstances, if 75 years ago, Congress had said to the President of the United States, if you make war unilaterally in violation of the war clause of the Constitution that gives Congress, not the President, the authority to go to war, and presidents did it, we only would have had to impeach one president or two for that constitutional sin. But we didn't, and so virtually every president since has usurped the war power. Now is the time, in my view, to reinforce the rule of law, have America stand strong so that we can tame any future president who might flaunt the Constitution and legal norms in our country.
So we have just a couple minutes left, Doctor, but maybe you could quickly address these two questions about, you know, future reforms. What do we need to do with campaign finance? And also, do you see the creation of a third party as any kind of salve or solution to the quandary we find ourselves in? Now, those are big questions. We only have a couple minutes, so maybe you can just quickly offer us an answer.
Thank you. Here's the Cliff Note answer to those good questions, and I admire and appreciate those questions. On the issue of financing, my own view is that we desperately need to turn to publicly financed campaigns. I think we've reached a point in America where people on both sides of the aisle have become so cynical about the role of private money and dark money. And the only way to move forward is to clean it up through the campaign finance laws, which would provide through publicly funded campaigns. I think that's the best way. It's fair, and it's much more consistent with our democratic values. So I would very much look forward to that. As to the creation of a third party, we always wonder about this as an antidote to the stranglehold that the two parties have on each system. I would have said some months ago that the time was ripe for the creation of a third party, but now I'm retreating a little bit, only because, Bill, I think in the Democratic Party, we have seen an accommodation between the moderate wing and the much more progressive wing. Both have great ideas and strengths. If they can find an accommodation, then I think the prospect of governing would, at least for a time, put a pause on the idea of the creation of a third party. However, I'm not so confident about the future of the GOP, and because Donald Trump maintains a grasp on this party. That's the Trumplican party, as many have said, and we don't have nearly the time to go into why Republicans have essentially abandoned their historical platform, which won many admirers, and have since caved into the cult of personality. And if President Trump announces his intention to run again in 2024, it will be fascinating to see how other Republicans watch. I think it stymies or freezes the GOP in its actions for the next few years. That would provide the basis for a separation. Moderate Republicans could essentially form their own little party marginalizing Donald Trump and his supporters. Big question. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but thanks for asking.
Well, and we may very well be talking about it in the future, Dr. Adler. So I want to thank you for joining us. This has been a City Club of Boise forum with Dr. David Adler talking about politics post-election. And we want to thank you for joining us. We want to thank our Boise State Public Radio audience for joining us. And we'll see you all next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you. Be safe.
You too.